Some years ago, in my days with what was then 102.5 The Bridge, before its reincarnation as Black Country Radio, I ran an afternoon chat show in which a wide range of the great and the good extended me the courtesy of sitting opposite in the hot seat. From holy men to engineers, charity founders to entertainers, we welcomed the lot. One such was a local comedian. Am I even allowed to employ that gender-specific term these days? Ah, how times change. But its use does narrow it down a bit as to whom I refer. Anyway, a local comedian who caused such uproarious merriment that saw me actually slide off my seat under the table in uncontrollable laughter, whilst in the next studio, and ostensibly being introduced to the finer points of broadcasting, a gaggle of visitors looking through the window were themselves doubled up with laughter, looking at me, doubled up with laughter. And the topic? My guest's ranting, excoriating diatribe on the difference between us Black Country yam-yams and our neighbours across the cultural divide beyond Here Be Dragons in Birmingham. Real knockabout stuff, and very, very funny in its mock deprecation of both. Though our sense of rivalry is of its own time and area, we are not alone, and there are numerous other examples of such parochial and, largely though not always similarly benign, antagonisms across the land. In my student days at Sunderland many years ago, for example, I quickly learnt the difference between Wearsiders and their neighbouring Geordies, both of whom, to the outsider, apparently spoke the same language. Note to self and my Brummie mates. They think we talk the same. Do you just hate that? Thus do yam-yams and Brummies coexist by continuing to hone their mutually disparaging but ultimately non-malevolent repertoire. But imagine for a moment the nomenclatures are changed to, let's say, Tutsi and Hutu. The Rwandan genocide was a mass slaughter of Tutsi and moderate Hutu during the Rwandan Civil War of 1994. Up to 1 million Rwandans were killed, about 70% of the Tutsi's population, and only ended with a military victory of the Rwandan Patriotic Front. Closer to home, but further back in history, the UK was the unwitting beneficiary of the dreadful religious persecution that led to an influx of Huguenots, who brought with them their skills including weaving, lace-making, and, particularly germane to the Stourbridge area, glass-making. We could similarly examine the opposing factions in the Irish Troubles, much of the Middle East, and many other parts of the globe. Now, throw into this mix the potential for strife induced by differences in skin colour, lifestyle choice, sexual orientation, or any other number of mutually incompatible factors that are politically de rigueur at the time, and we have a potent mix for the stirring of malcontent. All of these have two features in common. First, the problems, as loosely described here, are universally recognised. I guarantee I could count on the fingers of one hand the number of listeners who have not heard of, or maybe have even experienced for themselves, at least one. Second, at any given stage, and depending upon their prominence within a given political cycle, huge amounts of effort, perhaps by way of social intervention, education, or straightforward cash injections, are directed their way. Particularly, it seems, at election time. Or is that just the cynic in me baring its fangs? Yet there is one problem that still goes largely unreported, even unnoticed, certainly to the extent that little is actively done to address it. With a recognition factor that is inversely proportional to its capacity for destruction, it is a problem that has the potential to devastate society, yet in a quietly malignant way that may find us wanting when it is too late to address by the standard fallback methods we currently throw as we would lob a lifebelt. I'll name the problem in one word in just a moment. But before I do, let me set the scene with the entirely true tale of a pub I frequented with my dear late father when we lived in Wollaston near Stourbridge back in the 1980s. It's an Indian restaurant now, which is sad. But not because it's an Indian restaurant, and a rather good one at that, but because of what was lost in the transition. You see, every Friday night, my father and I would go there about 7 p.m. to be greeted by an already packed house that typically included a range of characters I'll attempt to describe. At the bar were a group of friends who, having worked hard all week, intended to play hard for the weekend, commencing with a few beers in their local, whilst attired in fancy dress of the day. One week they'd be American cowboys, the next a gaggle of Regency fops. One never knew. The far end of the bar, out of harm's way, were a group of workers in overalls that told of their immediate past history prior to their wearers relaxing by competing over a game of darts. In the lounge area to our left would be dinner-suited gents and coiffured ladies awaiting taxis to take them to the city for the evening. Birmingham in those days was a city of choice. Wolverhampton was yet to achieve the city status. Whilst in the back room, there might be a group of men, inevitably men of West Indian origin, playing their unique variation of overarm dominoes, and so on, but I think you get the picture. The point is, here was a microcosm of a representative, though not exhaustive, range of backgrounds, a cake slice through the ghetto of social strata, all mingling in bonhomie. The one thing that was not in any evidence whatsoever was that problem of one name I referred to earlier. Class. The class structure, that time-served feature of our lives that some would suggest has been the bedrock of our civilization almost since these islands were first populated. Institutionalized and ingrained to the extent that it is taken as the norm more so than its relevance to life in the 21st century is questioned, it is the glue that holds together the fabric of our social structure. But does it? Has the concept of class outgrown its usefulness to the extent that it may be damaging that which it seeks to protect? Embedded in the class structure still lies the notion of imperialism. A century since the foundations of the British Empire began to crumble, many of our institutions and aspects of our educational system are still geared to providing skills and leaders for an entity that no longer exists. Change has been afoot for decades, the move from grammar schools towards a comprehensive education system being a notable manifestation. But in this context, the general pace of such change has been anemic. In the meantime, the breaking down of arbitrary barriers, particularly the rise of feminism, disability empowerment and equal rights, has created a dichotomy where the established order is no longer fit for purpose. This is on a societal scale, but a poignant example of it that hits home was provided by a thinker from amongst our own ranks. Former MP and broadcaster Brian Walden, born in West Bromwich and the son of a glassmaker, had, prior to his death in May 2019, spent much of his life questioning the status quo. He told the simple but compelling tale, I would not be surprised if it were based on his own experience, of the factory operative, a working-class man as he describes, who studied, gained proficiency, and achieved promotion, but who could never elevate himself past a certain level as others passed him by. He wondered why, until his suspicions were confirmed one day, when the wealthy owner put his arm around his shoulder and congratulated him on a good morning's work. Now, said the owner, I'll go for my lunch and you can get your dinner. If true, and it certainly rings as such, this represents an appalling indictment on the pernicious effects of the sliding scale of class. It lurks silently in the shadows, largely unnoticed or ignored by disinterested onlookers passing by on the other side and upon whom it has no effect, but, by definition, afflicts in increasing degrees those who fall lower down the order. Yet, whilst piecemeal strikes from the wings may have a limited impact, there are no armies of social equalisers on the horizon preparing to cordon it off. Is it any wonder that people feel increasingly disenfranchised from those tasked with sourcing a resolution in plotting a path forward? And is this not being reflected in political upheavals, not just here, but across Europe, that see a swing away from the established parties towards those offering alternatives, some of which may be attractive when clutching for straws, but which are far from healthy under scrutiny in the longer term? This is powerful stuff, and it should be of serious concern. Whereas not so long ago, this reliance on one's background would, particularly in the days of empire and a more general attitude of accepted civility, have been accepted as the inevitable, if somewhat occasionally uncomfortable, norm. Society itself has moved on, whilst those same norms have remained hidebound. The growth in diversity, with all that entails in terms of broadening our communal perspectives, the explosion in education and the expectations arising therefrom, the recognition of alternate ways of lifestyle, the rise in alternate social mores, and perhaps more significantly, the profound shift in our country's role in a greater Europe and the world, in contrast with the time not so long ago when the sun never set on those parts we actually administered, all of these are at odds with the social scaffold fundamentally out of kilter with that it is intended to support. The long-term effect of this is at very least a weakening of the edifice. I'll proffer no firmer prognosis because it is simply too traumatic to imagine the consequences of total collapse. Yet it is not all doom and gloom, for we already have the nub of the solution in our grasp. That solution lies, as it inevitably must, in mutual respect and forbearance based on meritocracy, social mobility, interpersonal communications, anything, just anything, other than outmoded social ideals based around accidents of birth. And the result? Well, I give you Exhibit A, in the form of that once delightful pub in Wollaston. And to demonstrate how this works on a larger scale, I present the utterly compelling Exhibit B, namely, us black country folk and them there Brummies. Long may our feigned rivalry, but ultimately generous cohabitation, continue to offer the world a model of how, and in the best of humour, it can be achieved.